Pietro Novelli is a serial entrepreneur from Italy who went from high school directly into the workforce, landing his first full-time role at one of Italy's most innovative banks thanks to an interview he did about his local startup that emulated the business model of Groupon. From creating a digital agency and the world's first TV program on Facebook Live, to managing digital innovation at AXA and spending 5 years at Facebook in Ireland, Pietro has now combined his knowledge of luxury, technology, banking and insurance to launch a first of its kind, Voltique, a platform that insures luxury goods from theft directly with the brand, recently announcing a $2.5 million seed funding round. Season 3 of Tech Powered Luxury is proudly brought to you in partnership with our amazing sponsor, Farmhouse Fresh, an American skincare brand on a mission to rescue complexions and animals. Founded 19 years ago by Shannon McLinden, the brand has over 200 incredible skincare products with ingredients grown fresh on their farm in Texas. The Farmhouse Fresh custom-designed ranch headquarters is built on a 10-acre hill and is home to a hydroponic greenhouse, a spa and training facility, a non-profit farm animal sanctuary, meaning they are surrounded every day by the beautiful animals that they rescue. With 70 employees and thousands of spas who provide Farmhouse Fresh skincare experiences, Farmhouse Fresh is known for freshly grown skincare that rescues both complexions and animals. Loved by household names and celebrities around the globe, including Oprah, who discovered Farmhouse Fresh in 2007, as well as Catherine Zeta-Jones, Lisa Kudrow, and many, many more. Every single product from Farmhouse Fresh has a code that allows you to track and discover which animals were rescued thanks to your purchase. We could not have asked for a better partner for Season 3 of Tech Powered Luxury, who embodies luxury, technology, and most importantly, kindness into their business. Our listeners benefit from $10 off every $100 purchase with the code TLUXURY on farmhousefreshgoods.com. Hello, Pietro. How are you doing? Welcome to Tech Powered Luxury.
Hi, Ashley. I'm doing very well. How are you? Thank you so much for having me with you today.
I'm great. I'm so happy we were able to find a moment to have a very deep discussion on everything that you've done. The first time we met, I was absolutely fascinated about what you've created with your company, Voltique, but also we have a shared experience working in tech in Dublin for quite a few years, both of us. For you, actually, longer than me, even though I'm the Irish one. So I'm very excited to have you here. And before we jump in with everything to do with what you've created now with your company, Voltique, I'd like to ask you, who are you and what led you to where you are today?
Oh, that's a great question. So my name is Pietro Novelli. As you mentioned, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Voltique, a startup that basically is digitalizing ownership of luxury products. Previous to Voltique, as you mentioned, we had a similar background because I spent 5 years of my career at Meta, starting in Dublin, where I was working with Meta business partners. So all those companies developing solutions using the Facebook API. So companies like Shopify, WooCommerce, Smartly. And at the same time, I got offered a fantastic opportunity to work on e-commerce, fashion and luxury that then led to where I'm at today. And as you can hear from my accent, I'm Italian.
Amazing. Yes, and again, I know you were at Meta and I was at Google, but working on luxury brands within the tech space, it's a very, I would say, special intersection of industries because they're opposing in so many ways. And that's why Tech Powered Luxury was born as well, out of my passion and interest in these two spaces. Very similar to with Voltique. It wouldn't exist if you didn't, I think anyways, have that experience of how technology and luxury, they can feed each other and they can help each other grow, but they can also create new opportunities. So Pietro, I'm sure you got this question a lot in the past, like, how do I get a job at Meta? How do I get a job at tech? And I wanted to ask you, well, how did you get your job at Meta to begin with? And, what was your education background that led you to that first really pivotal step in your career?
So I didn't have a traditional journey. After secondary school, I decided to not proceed with my studies. Because basically I wanted to support my family, but I've always been very, very ambitious. I've always been fascinated about tech companies and the opportunity of working in the Silicon Valley. I remember one day when I was 19 years old and I was in the living room watching this video about the story of Google. And basically I went to my parents' bedroom. I woke them up and I asked them to come to the living room, you know, to see this video, to watch this video. And I told them, you know, one day I will work for one of those companies. One day I will go to Silicon Valley. I remember my mom crying and, you know, please, no, don't leave us. And my dad, you know, was like, where do you want this guy to go? You know,
Peter, I love that story. And I think it's really important for people to hear that not going to university doesn't mean that you can't achieve your dreams, actually, especially in a digital first world. Doesn't always correlate. And a lot of the guests that we have had on Tech Power Luxury, they have studied things so far away from luxury and technology, but in the end, they just follow their passion. And if you find a passion and pursue that passion, if you're hardworking, you can make anything happen. So obviously your mum really believed that you were going to end up in Silicon Valley because she was immediately upset that you were going to be going so far away, which is great. So your educational path, it was a little bit different. You started working straight away, I'm guessing. So can you tell me a little bit about the kind of first days and months, weeks, I guess, of your working career after secondary school?
Yeah, so it was really intense. So after, you know, like as mentioned before, I was, you know, I've always been very ambitious and I always wanted to work in tech. But of course, without an education, it was very hard, you know, to build a career, you know, in tech and working, you know, and achieve my dreams to work for these big tech companies. So after trying, you know, a few little jobs, I decided, okay, you know what? Maybe it's time for me to, you know, to try to launch a startup. And I was 21 years old when I launched my first business. It was basically a copycat of Groupon, because at the time I heard this story of these two German brothers copying business models from the US, replicating them in Europe, and then exiting the companies. So I said, oh, you know, I can try something similar. So I created, like a copycat of Groupon, but focused on small cities in the north of Italy, and it was called Bidil. You know, it was actually, you know, like a good success at the point that I gave a couple of interviews. And from one of these interviews, I received a call from one of the most important Italian banks proposing me a job. So at that point, you know, I decided to join that bank. And it was very exciting because it's one of the most innovative banks in Italy. It's called Banca Sella. And with them, I worked on the first Facebook banking for the Italian market. And at the same time, to one of the first mobile banking apps for the market as well. So it was very exciting. But you know, sometimes banking is quite slow, and I really wanted that pace that tech companies can give you. So I decided to leave my small city in the north of Italy and move to Milan, which to me was bigger at that point, where I founded my first digital agency. And I was very excited at the point I had three main clients. One was Bordbia, that you might know very well. So the Irish food board,
a big company in Ireland.
Exactly, the Irish food board for the promotion of the Irish food in the world. So and I was basically promoting Irish food and meat specifically, for the Italian market. At the same time, I was working with Audi and Calvin Klein jewelry. You know, that was my first time I approached luxury. You know, I was working with jewelers in Italy, you know, and explaining them how to use social media to reach new clients. And then at that point, Facebook came up with a new feature, which was the live feature. And I came up with another idea and I said, oh, you know what? Maybe we can create something out of it. And I launched the first TV show ever streamed on Facebook. I was producing it. I was not in front of the camera, too shy to be in front of a camera. But it was really exciting. Basically, the whole concept was, you know, one day I was on a couch watching TV. I was feeling lonely. I said, oh, you know what? It would be cool to have someone on my phone commenting what I'm watching with me. So that was the concept. It went viral at the point that after five episodes, we reached more than a million unique users in the country. And Italy is not a big market, as you might know. So we got a lot of exposure on, you know, local newspapers, you know, and national newspapers as well. Really exciting experience. At the point, though, I needed to move abroad and I decided to leave Italy and move to Ireland. You know, maybe the connection with Bordbia, but the real reason is that I got a job offer from AXA, the insurance company, to work there. But at the same time, you know, my ambition has always been to work for tech. And you know that Dublin is the capital in Europe for tech companies. You know, everyone is there. So if you want to work in tech, go to Dublin. You know, at least you get a chance. I worked for AXA, really exciting. But, you know, I spent my first few years in Dublin applying for Facebook. And, you know, and it got rejected so many times until the point that it said, okay, maybe it's the time for me to, you know, to change country, move back to Italy. But then was the time when I got my call, you know, from Facebook offering me a job exactly on the day that I was, that I decided to quit my job at AXA and move back to the country. I got the call from Facebook. So, and then, you know, my life changed completely.
That's crazy. You got the call on the day you were planning on leaving. And I feel you with the, you know, 5 years of trying to get into Meta. I actually checked a couple of years ago and I had applied for Google for 10 consecutive years before I finally got an interview.
Exactly.
You just have to keep trying. Like, it's perseverance. It's not giving up. These things don't happen by accident. And I'm sure from the outside, Pietro, people might look at your career and think, oh yeah, he, you know, one application, got in straight away, moved to Dublin. Actually, no, you were there in the city for 5 years.
I remember actually during one of those interviews with Meta, because as you know, it's a very, you know, long process to get a job in, you know, one of these big tech companies. I remember they asked me, Pietro, what would you do, you know, if we decide to don't hire you at this point? My answer was, it's simple. I will apply again. You know, like, I don't have any other choice. I will do it again until you guys will offer me a job. So, like, I think, you know, showing that you really want that job and, you know, that that's the thing that you want to do is really important, because the competition is really high, and it's not only about your skill set, but it's also about, you know, your, the passion that you have and your drive, you know, and how much you're aligned with the mission of that specific company. And at the time, you know, when Meta was still Facebook, I was really aligned with the mission of the company of, you know, bringing the world closer together by using social media. And indeed, I saw that mission coming to life during the pandemic, for instance. Imagine the pandemic without WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook. Right? You know, without sharing content on those platforms and connecting with your loved ones and, you know, using the social media platforms, it would have been, you know, very hard, in my opinion, to manage emotionally without these fantastic tools.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And never mind communicating, you know, with your friends and whatnot, but imagine having to work without having social media or Zoom. I mean, we saw the Zoom boom or Google Meets, whatever it is people were using. If we didn't have that, we also, I think, would have plunged into a much bigger economic crisis, because how would we have worked? I know I wouldn't have been able to work. Like, I wasn't able to go to the office, but instead probably worked more than ever before during at least those 2 years of being online. Same for you. Like, if you were in the tech space, it was busy because every company needed you to help them succeed, especially luxury brands who all of a sudden couldn't operate in retail and everything moved online.
Yeah.
But that brings me to the next question that I had for you. So when you first joined Meta, yes, you were an avid user of social media. You'd launched, you know, this first ever TV show that was through Facebook Live. But what were the biggest challenges when you first joined the company? I imagine there was a bit of a culture shock, because these companies have strong cultures and really specific ways of working. So could you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's another very interesting question. You know, when people ask me about my time at Meta, I usually start with this example that comes always from, you know, my very first interview process, because I had many interview processes when, you know, because I first joined as a contractor and then I applied for an FT role. So you have to go through the process again, you know, and at the end of the first interview process with Leila McDonald, she asked me one question that I didn't prepare at all, which was, so Pietro, very last question, why Facebook? You know, and my answer was very straightforward. It came out so naturally, but then thinking about it was, you know, a very cool answer, because I answered, look, imagine going to a Formula One race, right? And, you know, at the entrance, they ask you, you know, do you want to sit front row and enjoy the show, or do you want to pick a helmet and drive a car? I want to drive a car. I want to win the race. Because that was Meta for me at the time. That was, you know, the biggest opportunity of my life. And imagine it, without a university degree, joining a company like Meta will change completely my career, right? And, you know, that's what it meant to me for real. And of course, you know, when you then join a company, you know, big corporate like Meta, I think, you know, majority of people will go through the same mental process and suffering what is called imposter syndrome, Because at the beginning, you know, didn't feel enough. You know, I felt like I was almost a scam. You know, did they really understand who I am? You know, did they really know, you know, what I'm capable to do? You know, why I'm in this room with all these smart people? You know, because previous to Meta, you know, and maybe it's not nice to say, but, you know, sometimes I felt like I was the smartest person in the room. When you join those companies, you know, you're not the smartest person in the room. And sometimes, you get shy and scared of asking questions during important meetings with, you know, big, you know, vice presidents, you know, directors, you know, being there with you. So I think that was the biggest challenge with me, for me. And at the same time, I guess another very important thing that I learned is the approach. Because when you join these companies, you know, you don't, you know, of course you have an onboarding process, but basically you find an email in your mailbox saying, hey, you have to meet these people, go and figure out what you have to do. Okay, so if you don't have this entrepreneurial approach to work and life, it's impossible to survive and succeed within those environments. And that's what I learned as well, you know, building those relationships, understanding the needs of, you know, of my stakeholders and my clients, and building projects and products that could solve for those problems, you know, while at the same time fostering communities, because communities is at the core of everything that you do within a company like Meta. So I would say these are the two main challenges. One, you know, imposter syndrome at the beginning. On the other side, you know, like figure out by yourself what is that you have to do in order to succeed, you know, and grow, you know, within those companies.
Really interesting points. And I can imagine when you were in that interview and you came out with that response, they could only think, okay, this guy is going to be so grateful for this opportunity and he's going to want to prove himself every single day because he knows that this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And actually, they're the people in the past that I've seen anyways that, you know, create the most success for companies. It's not the ones coming in and that felt, well, I was entitled to this job. Of course I have it. And maybe I should have been hired at a more senior level. And I don't know why I'm doing these tasks. I did more important things before, but you were coming in with a very different mindset. And that's the kind of mindset that these companies really want and really need. So it's more important than a degree at the end of the day.
Exactly. But then, you know, I think that what makes the difference are people, right? I got lucky enough to start in Dublin. I mean, you're Irish, you know, I love the Irish culture and how Irish people approach, you know, personal relationships and work. And, you know, like my managers have, you know, always been Irish. You know, the last one was, you know, Laura Gaffney. You know, she helped me a lot through this process. She helped me grow. You know, she put me in the position of, you know, to grow and shine and, you know, and giving me the opportunity to, you know, bring my ideas to life. You know, and turn them into real projects that then changed, you know, at some point the way we approached, the way we were doing business with partners, for instance, or when I worked in luxury as well within the company. So I got lucky enough to work with the right people because people always make the difference. You know, you can work, at the end of the story, a company is just a group of people believing in the same mission, right? Working together, believing in something, you know, that is bigger than just making money. And that's one another very important lesson, you know. Once you understand that, you know, you don't have to change job based on the salary and how much money you can make, but on, you know, what that company can give you in terms of values, you know, that can give to you and that you can transmit to, you know, in your daily life also to people around you, I think that's when you can really succeed, right? Because then you have love for what you do. And love is, you know, I think is the main drive for success.
Absolutely. Couldn't say it better myself. It's always when I speak with Italians that they're like, love is important, passion is important. I love to hear that because it's true. Without it, like, what's the point?
Exactly.
Season 3 of Tech Powered Luxury is proudly brought to you in partnership with our amazing sponsor, Farmhouse Fresh, an American skincare brand on a mission to rescue complexions and animals. Our listeners benefit from $10 off every $100 purchase with the code TLUXURY on farmhousefreshgoods.com.
But Pietro, now all of that obviously has brought you to a new chapter of your life. Now you're not living in Italy or in Ireland, you're living in London. You have a new company. I met you through the amazing Beatrice Boros, who has been a contributor to Tech Powered Luxury since before it launched even. So can you tell me about what you're doing now Voltique. It's also had a couple of iterations already. So yeah, I'd love for you to just give me an introduction overall to the company and what it does.
So Voltique is the company connecting luxury brands, connecting and protecting luxury brands and their clients through every product purchase. So basically, we digitalize the ownership of luxury products to unlock exclusive experiences and perks for owners. To give you an example, the most innovative part of our technology and, you know, is positioning us in a very exclusive way in the market is the fact that we can, you know, give insurance on luxury products for theft, loss, and damage through the digital assets tied to them, right? So while there is a new regulation coming out from the European Union for digital product passports, right, so that are basically integrated on garments through NFC chips and QR codes. There are also other methodologies to do it, but mainly in these two ways. You know, companies right now, luxury brands are struggling to understand, you know, how to really deliver value beyond the regulation, which of course is super important because, you know, it's tied to the fact that brands have to provide consumers with all the information about supply chain in order to help them make more conscious decisions, right? So, but how can you actually then use these digital assets, you know, and physical and the physical integration on the garment to elevate the luxury experience of clients? That's what we actually do. That's our mission.
Very concise introduction. For people who maybe are less aware of the tech side of what you're doing with Voltique. So maybe listeners who, maybe they have a luxury item, they have a luxury handbag or a luxury watch. Could you talk me through how Voltique would impact that item that they own and how it would insure it?
Yeah, that's, you know, very good question. Look, when working on the value proposition of Voltique, I struggled a little bit because to me, you know, a project a digital product has to be as easy to explain as, you know, talking with your grandmother, right? So, you know, the example that I always present to people when talking about Voltique is imagine your grandmother going to the bank to hand gold, you know, and, you know, valuable products and things that she owns for safekeeping, right? So we basically digitalize this process, you know, in the digital era, which means that we create digital vaults to help you protect your products, right? While you can keep wearing them with confidence while going around, you know, big cities like London and Paris. Like, I came up with this idea because a few months ago I got robbed, right? So I was out of a club here in London, you know, eight people around me, they took everything I had. Right. The day after, of course, was a traumatic experience. And the day after, you know, I woke up and I said, there's nothing I can do and there's nothing who can help me at this point. Right. I mean, someone has to solve for this problem. So I basically then connected this issue, this traumatizing experience that I had to something that is on the market right now and that needs to be improved, like digital product passports. Right. So that's in simple words what we do. We use, you know, the digital identity of physical products to help owners of luxury products to protect their watches, their handbags, you know, and their valuable possessions. That's what we do. I hope this clarifies and gives a more clear explanation of our value proposition.
Absolutely. And when we spoke, it was during Paris Fashion Week, actually, you were telling me about the way that you collaborate directly with brands. And of course, me coming from someone in a luxury group as well, I found this super interesting and it made a lot of sense because it simplifies the process. So me as a luxury consumer, for example, I go and buy, let's say, a Gucci handbag, but it's not up to me to go and take care of this whole process with Voltique. It's actually going to be the brand that takes care of it directly. So can you tell me about how you came up with that concept? Because I imagine it took some time to figure out, like, who do we connect the dots with? And as a consumer versus a brand, who takes responsibility for what?
Yeah. So basically, you know, like, when we joined the acceleration program with Farfetch last year, with Farfetch and Outlier Ventures, you know, we were positioned as a Web3 company. You know, NFT was the buzzword. Everyone was excited about them. But then, you know, the market collapsed. you know, and people started getting scared about the terminology and everything. And in the same time, while having conversation with luxury brands, what we understood is that, first of all, CFOs don't want to hear the word crypto. At the same time, you know, when providing and generating values for the end customers, you don't want to create any sort of complication or any sort of friction points for them. So our ambition has always been the one to simplify as much as possible this experience by leveraging the value, you know, that the technology can generate, right? So basically our technology integrates through a single line of code within any commerce platform, right? Both online and in-store. So that when a client, you know, completes the purchase of a luxury product, they simply receive an email with a redeem code, right? That redeem code that can be used to redeem their luxury products within their digital vault. I like to see this pretty much as the process of magic, right? Where you take something that is already there, you know, as you know, which is a product, your normal experience, you know, and then you create something new out of it to then normalize again the experience, right? That's how magic works. And that's what we do. You know, your experience when you go on, you know, on the website, you know, of clients that integrate our technology is the same as has always been. But, you know, the only difference that after completing the transaction, you receive this redeem code that gets you access to the digital asset. Through the digital asset, you then have access to the insurance component that is completely covered by the brand. Why is that? Because, of course, as a luxury consumer, you know, you want to live a luxury experience. Sorry for repeating luxury so many times, but you definitely know what I mean when I talk about this. So you want to elevate the experience of your clients. You don't want to create any friction through that journey, right? So in this way, brands cover for the insurance premium. Clients can benefit from this protection for theft, loss, and damage while unlocking experiences as well tied to the products that they buy. And basically the way brands benefit is by, you know, when I give you an example, Ashley, that, you know, let's pretend you lost your new Chanel handbag. I'm sorry to, you know, to make this example. But basically what happens is that you claim insurance for our technology. Chanel receives money from the insurance company and you get a new bag from Chanel. In this way, we increase loyalty, you know, and you get your bag and you're protected while Chanel is selling a new handbag.
It's super interesting. And it was really when you explained this to me that the money doesn't go to me, Ashley, who lost or had stolen or whatnot, her Chanel bag. It actually goes to Chanel. And that is the luxury experience, because then Chanel makes sure that I get my bag again and that they don't lose a customer. Because what happens a lot with a luxury client, if something happens to an item that they own, whether it's damaged or lost or stolen, even if they get the money back, first issue is the money that they get usually is not enough to go and buy a replacement. This is something I've heard from anyone I know, actually, that's had a theft or a loss of an item. They don't get enough to go buy the item again. So what happens is they either decide to spend the money on something else or they spend it with a different brand. And either way, they have lost, you know, that brand has lost a customer who was probably a very loyal one and who really valued this item that they had. So I can see from a brand perspective why it would make a lot of sense for me to work with you, because I'm basically kind of taking care of their community as well. But I imagine it's the really high priced items that this makes a lot of sense for. It's going to be less so for sneakers or maybe for ready to wear, but more so watches, jewelry, handbags, those items that have a higher price point, let's say. So could you talk me through your business model at the moment? You know, is that the reality? Is it mainly these higher priced items that are being insured? And how do you collaborate with brands?
Yeah. So as mentioned before, you know, one of the main issues, while on the customer side, you know, we provide peace of mind, you know, for the luxury products that they own. On the other side, brands are facing challenges for, you know, the distribution of digital product passports, because what we have been learning from them is that, you know, while there is a big investment that they have to do to integrate this technology on physical garments, imagine that less than 1% of their clients are actually scanning them to then access the information, right? So Of course, you know, through the insurance protection, we're giving customers a strong reason to then scan the QR code or the NFC chip and access the information, unlock insurance, and unlock experiences. So for this reason, of course, high ticket items are the ones that are more interesting to us at this stage, right? Which means that, you know, we mainly work with big luxury companies with a focus on handbags, you know, watches, accessories in general, because there's less depreciation of value of those specific products over time. And less with fashion garments, right? Well, instead, you know, the insurance component that is more relevant is about damage and so repair, which is a painful process for brands, and we're trying to help them as well. So, yeah, as mentioned, you know, big luxury brands that are interested and have to provide this type of technology by 2030 and want to generate more value out of this, you know, physical component and chips that are integrating on the garments while generating a new revenue stream. Because again, you know, to go back to the insurance side, imagine, Ashley, that in 2021 alone, $9.2 billion worth of luxury products got stolen, you know, which is pretty much a $60 billion opportunity globally. It's a massive opportunity. And these money right now are just lost or out of, you know, brands are not generating any value out of this product that are stolen, right? Well, instead, what we do is turning these, you know, products that are lost, you know, or stolen into a new revenue opportunity for them. So big luxury brands, retailers, everyone doing consignment. We just went live last week with a consignment store here in London. And we're very excited about it because this can unlock, you know, great opportunities in the resale market as well. And but the long-term vision for us is for small and medium businesses and small artisans. When we talk about luxury, to me, you know, it's not about, you know, expensive products, as people might think. To me, it's about the craftsmanship. You know, the small artisan in the middle of nowhere in Italy, you know, making and crafting shoes that then you buy in boutiques here in London. Right? That's for me what luxury is. And at some point with this new regulation, these small and medium businesses will have to, you know, be compliant as well. Who's going to support them? That's how, why our technology is adopted a SaaS model. So that, you know, now we're working with big corporates that have big budgets, big teams that can actually implement these type of solutions. But in the long term, we will have a self-serve platform so that small entrepreneurs and artisans and everyone collaborating and contributing to the luxury industry can actually be compliant and provide similar solutions to their consumers. So this is I gave you the short-term vision, you know, for big luxury brands and retailers, resellers and consignment, and to them, you know, moving on in the future and, you know, be focused more on the long tail of small and medium businesses.
Absolutely. And you had me thinking there, you know, you're talking about it's a SaaS. It starts off now with you're buying like a new luxury item. It's insured thanks to Voltique. But then you also spoke about now you just launched consignment. This is when we first met. This is what I thought. This makes so much sense for anyone that buys a luxury item that maybe they want to resell later, because it's also a way to authenticate the item. So you have this, you know, Web3 component, really, this ledger that's able to say this is an authentic item. This came straight from the brand, and you can see the history of, you know, what has happened with this product since it left the brand. Do you see that as the next frontier for you?
Yeah, totally. And look, we have a patent pending in the US for a process that we created to authenticate and validate the authenticity of physical assets. The basic concept behind it is that, you know, while QR codes and NFC chips can be replicated, and we saw that happening already, right? And so, you know, an NFC chip or a digital product passport says that this product is now its product number 12345, right? What we basically do, while this product 12345 can be replicated, 12345/Ashley is only one, right? So tying the identity of the owner to the identity of the product is, in our opinion, what can really solve this issue and create a digital identity of the product. which is made not only by, you know, the unique serial number that is on the product with, you know, everything regarding supply chain and how the product was created, but also about the ownership history of the product, which means that Ashley is now selling this product to Pietro, is not only selling, you know, the product with a certificate of ownership, but also with a digital product passport. These two components, you know, together certify that I'm buying an original and authentic asset, you know, and together with them, I can access the experiences. And for instance, I mentioned before also the insurance component that, you know, will protect me along the way, but also knowing every time that Ashley accessed a repair service for that specific bag, right? So these are very important components, you know, that, you know, can help consumers, customers make more conscious decisions when buying a new product.
Absolutely. And it actually sounds like you've really married all of your former experiences in insurance, in tech, in the kind of the luxury focused spaces all into one. So you have a lot of legitimacy in this space as well. And that leads me to my next question. So when we first met, actually, it was with the fabulous Stephanie from Forbes, who had interviewed you to announce that 2.5 million seed funding round that was led by Ken Krohn's, the operating group. So can you talk me through that?
Yeah, so raising capital. So basically, this was the first time for me going through this process and raising capital in this way, right? For a tech startup, I did it, you know, business, you know, and you know, startups before, but in a different way, right? So this was a completely, you know, new journey and experience for me, and I've been learning so much. And to be honest, it's been, you know, really intense to manage emotionally. And raising capital is a job on its own because, you know, while you have to raise capital, have all these conversations with investors, you know, you have to manage the money that you have in your bank account to pay salaries for your team that is there and manage product development and try to onboard clients at the same time, try to convince them that this new technology is the thing that they will need in the future. So when we actually opened our seed round in February, Kunal Chand and I, Kunal is my business partner, is based in New York. And, you know, we started doing business together more than 5 years ago. We tried a couple of e-commerce, with a couple of e-commerce websites. You know, we tried dropshipping, of course, is I think a lot of people. We failed miserably with a couple of them, but we learned a lot. Then we got to this point and we built a very sustainable and long-term strategy we are actually applying. And when we opened the seed round, as well, as I was mentioning, to be honest, we didn't struggle much to find Ken because we knew exactly what, you know, what type of investor we wanted to have on board. Ken is fantastic. Imagine that he was leading Universal Game when they launched World of Warcraft. He went public with two companies on the Nasdaq. So he's a fantastic entrepreneur. And what I really wanted to have from an investor was not the type of relationship with a VC that you meet every 3 months just to share how your company is performing, but having someone next to you, you know, from whom you can learn on a daily basis, right? When I have issues, you know, when I have, you know, new ideas, when I need a, you know, piece of advice, I just send a message to Ken. Ken jumps on a call with me, you know, and, you know, helps me, you know, understand and navigate through the different challenges. So it's a learning process because, you know, it's not because you launch a startup that you're a CEO. You know, you have to become a CEO. That's, you know, that's a process, right? You have, there are a lot of components that you have to learn how to manage. And the best way to learn is by, you know, having next to you someone who went through the process in a very successful way. So that's why I was very excited to meet Ken and then receive this investment from him. And we are now completely on the same page. He is completely aligned with our vision at the point that we invite him to, you know, clients' meetings as well. So, yeah, like, very excited about this partnership, very excited to be on this journey with Ken, with Kunal, of course, Anthony, who is actually Ken's business partner. You know, I truly believe that together we can achieve something unique and remarkable. You know, of course, what makes the difference between, you know, now having a good idea, a company with, you know, money in the bank and a successful company is the execution. So now we're very committed in delivering the best experience and working really hard to get there.
That's super interesting. And thanks for the transparency and sharing that little insight with us. And it's so true. Raising, it's something that has to happen on the sideline. It can't just take over your business. The business business doesn't just get put on pause for you to take some time to go raise some money. It's the opposite. Probably you need to be accelerating in the background to make sure that you get the best evaluation as possible. And I'm glad you found not just an investor, but someone who's an advisor and really on board with the mission of Voltique.
Totally. And Stephanie helped us a lot because, you know, when going through the race of course, getting some media exposure, like on Forbes, which is very important, of course, for a small startup, was very instrumental to us. Because, you know, you need to gain momentum. And it's all about momentum.
Yeah.
Every time, that's what another thing that I learned. It's all about momentum, you know. Everyone is excited. You know, you have people, you know, around you that want to work with you, that want to join the company, that want to partner with you as client, you know, as strategic partners as well. And investors, when they see this, you know, all this excitement about, you know, around something, then, of course, they're more likely to invest.
It's a
right?
Really
no
good
one
point.
Wants to invest on a startup that is not exciting yeah. or that has the potential to succeed.
Absolutely. And it doesn't just, like you said, count for the investment, but also for getting clients. Like if, you know, a major luxury brand sees that you've already partnered with their competitor, they're going to be thinking, OK, well, if it's been vetted and validated by our closest competitor who holds the same standards that we do, then this is going to be good. And same for talent. I mean, we've both seen it with Meta and with Google. Those companies, they attract the best talent in the world. People are, you know, doing everything they can, applying for 5 to 10 years to positions just so that they can get in and start at the bottom.
Totally. And I think one of the mistakes that then, you know, entrepreneurs end up doing is when you enter the innovation competition, right? And then you see, you know, other companies coming up and trying to do what they do, they try to pivot too much, right? They say, oh, no, I'm not special enough. I need to do something slightly different. I need to come up with a new piece of technology to be ahead of the competition. Instead, what I learned is that it's better if you keep focusing on what you were doing and do, you know, what you want to do in the best way possible to deliver the best experience, right? I think what makes the difference between, you know, again, a successful company, even, you know, in sport, an athlete, you know, it's you have a 100% performance. Usually people get to the 90% and they feel satisfied, right? Instead, you know, there's still that, you know, small 10%, which is what really makes the difference. And that's what I always tell our team. We have to work for the 10% because everyone can get to the 90 and feel satisfied about what they're delivering and what they're, you know, providing, you know, to the industry, to customers, to anyone around, to all the stakeholders around. But the real difference is in that small, tiny 10%. And that's where we work every day, honestly, because, you know, we want to, again, to deliver the best experience possible without thinking too much about the competition. The competition is just with ourselves.
I really like that. And that's really a tech mindset, a Silicon Valley mindset, you know. And it's something that I think a lot of, you know, early stage entrepreneurs, they find it hard to get that focus on, okay, just focus on what we're creating. Don't look at the competition. And it's really important because otherwise paranoia kicks in. Are people copying my product? Is someone else coming with something slightly better, slightly different? But if you build the best product and the best business and you have the market share and just keep moving forward like that, that's the winning strategy in the end.
Totally. Exactly.
So you've spoken about the fact that now it's execution. It's time to execute. You know, you've built the concept. You've had lots of, I'd say, trial and error, test and learn with the different types of business models. Voltique, it's the winning formula for you in terms of product and a need on the market. Can you tell me about the first client that you got? So your first customer of Voltique.
So actually, this is something relatively recent, let's say, because we have just completed the product development last month. We have our app on the App Store and, you know, our SaaS platform is now ready. The e-commerce widget is fully ready. So now we're navigating through the onboarding of the first luxury brand. I can't say the name right now, but it's a big, you know, it's an Italian luxury brand. Very exciting. As part of Kering Group. I don't want to mention which one right now.
We'll be I won't say it out loud.
Announced soon. But at the same time, we're unlocking a lot of very interesting conversations, also with companies producing watches. So, and, you know, watches is, you know, one of our, you know, of my big passions. And so I'm really excited about, you know, the opportunity to unlock these conversations and see where they can go. And again, the most important component of these conversations and these partnerships that we're creating with these luxury brands is about really providing this peace of mind to their clients, right? While at the same time, turning products into a channel to unlock exclusive experiences for them, right? So getting the most out of this digital product passport and this new regulation that is coming up in the coming years.
Super interesting. And at the moment, like, what does your day-to-day look like? Who are you interacting with?
My team, first of all, we have more than, we have almost 17 people right now. You know, we have people in Japan. You know, our devs are in Japan, four of them. We have Takao, Seichi, Guo, Tan, all based in Japan. We have people in Uruguay. We have Samir in Belgium. Rami is in Istanbul. Beatrice in Milan. You know, like Gianluca in Dublin. Kunal is in New York. We are a really global team. And that's my, you know, piece of my heart. I'm very proud of them because we went through a lot of challenges together, especially, you know, when you are under pressure to deliver for clients. You know, we mentioned before, you know, about our first client. You know, of course, when you work with these big luxury brands, these big corporations, you feel the pressure to over-deliver. And we always have this approach to under-promise and try to over-deliver. That's, you know, how we try to, you know, manage expectations with clients. So I'm very proud because we just went through a very intense moment to then present our first POC that will be activated very soon. Apart from them, you know, as mentioned before, we interact with a lot of luxury brands, you know, from LVMH to, you know, Richemont to Kering, you know, a lot of luxury corporations and conglomerates. But at the same time, also with small brands and small retailers that, you know, can unlock the opportunity for small and medium businesses in the long term.
Super interesting. And the fact that you have this global team and you're going through this big phase of growth and development and change, and I assume all of these people are remote, or at least they're maybe together in different countries. So how do you make sure that you still have a company culture, that people collaborate together?
Look, that's something that, again, I learned during my time at Meta, because of course, while maybe your, you know, direct team is sitting there next to you, you end up working with people all around the world, and maybe you don't even work with people sitting next to you. So, you know, one of the things that I really liked during my time at Meta was, you know, this culture, cultural way of gathering and meeting and working together through offsites. And that's what we tend to do. So we're trying to, you know, arrange certain moments during the year where we get together and we really work together to, first of all, we get together to get to know each other better, right? Spend some quality time together, but at the same time work together, which makes a huge difference. Of course, it's not easy. And my business partner and I are also thinking to, you know, maybe have an office in London next year, and maybe grow our London team, you know, so that we can have, you know, a central place where people can come and meet and gather and spend time together and work together. I think that would be instrumental. For now, of course, a lot of calls. We, you know, we spend a lot of time on calls. We spend a lot of time on the phone. You know, we try to be and stay connected as much as possible. And, you know, when we have business trips, I always try to invite the team as well. You know, like based on the different things that we might need, you know, I might invite people. Of course, it's very hard for me to spend time with the guys in Japan.
Be a nice place to spend time.
it's not easy. Exactly. And I've never been to Tokyo, so I'm planning to go there very soon, while at the same time arranging our next offsite. It would probably be during Art Basel in Miami.
Super exciting. And we actually haven't really mentioned it, which is interesting. And it shows kind of how times have changed and the words that we use have changed. But immediately when you said Art Basel Miami, I thought of NFTs, Web3, Metaverse. Like, these are all the buzzwords that were being used at Art Basel over the last couple of years. But in the last couple of months in particular, everyone in the industry has moved away from those words because of the way the market has gone. Is that something that you've been consciously doing as well to make sure that people maybe don't come in with some biases?
Yeah, totally. Look, I truly believe, and we saw this and we learned this throughout history, that, you know, a lot of times brands, companies, you know, act out of FOMO. you know, oh, there's this new big thing. Let's try to do something. Look, actually, I know about a luxury brand that at some point launched an NFT collection without even having a crypto wallet and an NFT wallet.
Wow.
I don't know how they managed to do that. Yeah, through an agency. That was like, guys, you know, that's not
how
the approach. But exactly. But at the same time, you know, I'm conscious also of the influence that, you know, big companies like Meta, you know, had, you know, on this process. Because, of course, when Mark Zuckerberg woke up on a day, we didn't know it as employees. When he woke up on a day and said, oh, you know, today, you know, we're rebranding the company. You know, we're now called Meta, and we're betting on the metaverse. And everyone was, oh, okay, what is the metaverse? What do we have to do? This and that. Yeah, so as mentioned before, we tried with our technology and with our company to remove all the buzzwords, to remove, you know, all the terminology and really focus on the value that we ship through the technology. The example that I always make is when you go on Google, you know, and you're searching something, when you then get the results, you're not there wondering, oh, what is the algorithm showing me this, you know, this link here, right?
Unless you're a Googler, you know, or ex-Googler. Sometimes I wonder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Why it is important for the company itself, for the end consumer, is not important. Consumers get scared very easily, mm-hmm. right? Because they receive a lot of information. They get overwhelmed by the amount of information. And then another very important thing is, you know, and this I think is really funny, because, you know, we talk about innovation, we talk about metaverse, we talk about Web3, but then is the end consumer ready?
Mm.
You know, there are certain parts in my country, in Italy, where you don't even have internet connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, how do you, you know, like, well, there are certain parts of the population and certain brands that try to push forward, you know, certain concepts and technology out of FOMO. You know, I believe that, you know, most of the times they don't think about the real value that can be shipped to the end consumer, to the end customer.
Mm.
And that's something that we always have to keep in mind, because otherwise then you end up failing. And the metaverse is an example, because everyone started building virtual worlds. Then Apple came out, you know, a few months ago saying, oh, we have a new fantastic device, you know, for mixed reality. And now the bet is mixed reality, right? So, which is different than a completely 3D environment. So, that's my point of view. Of course, it's exciting. I believe that 3D can play a very important role. Even for designers, you know, we worked on a project with a fashion brand, where we basically helped them use, you know, VR headset for fast prototypation. In this way, you can reduce the waste, you know, when you want to, you know, create prototypes of new clothes or new garments. You know, you don't need the actual fabric, but you can, you know, first create it in 3D. And if you really like it and if it makes sense, then you can move to real production, right? These are ways, interesting ways of applying the technology. You know, when we said work out of FOMO, I think is, you know, the risk of failing is super high.
It's a really good point. And something that you said there really made me think for a moment about fear. And as soon as there's any fear linked to a specific word or sometimes industry or whatnot, it can be really damaging for all companies in that space. And it's probably very unfortunate for Meta, because there was so much hype around that. And it's, I mean, it comes in cycles, right? We saw it, well, we were very young, so probably don't remember it, but, you know, the dot-com boom, which we heard about in the early thousands, when, you know, the internet kind of became a thing, and, oh, let's launch websites and let's pump loads of money into these and invest in websites. But there was no added value behind these websites. And I think the same thing happened with NFTs. And when you got to, you know, an end potential customer and they said, but what does the NFT actually do? And if the thing that it does is nothing more than you having access to this, you know, virtual asset, it's not very exciting and there is no value there. But what you've managed to do is leverage that technology and implemented it into something that does create value. And it's one of the first use cases that I have seen that really makes sense, not just for the brand, but also for the end consumer. And that's why, personally, I'm very excited about Vaultique, because I see it from both standpoints, me as a luxury consumer and me as someone that works in-house within a luxury group. So I love what you're doing. It's really exciting. I hope you're really, really proud. And I feel like you've had that full circle moment. And hopefully, you know, there'll be some kids out there watching you on TV very soon talking about what you're doing. Or maybe they'll listen to the podcast and tell their parents, this is what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to work for a company like this someday, because it's it's really inspiring, and I can tell how passionate and how much you care about your team and your mission is. So I'm sure you're going to go very, very far.
Thank you very much, Ashley. It was a real pleasure to be here with you today. And a big thank you also to everyone listening today, the TPL community, your audience. You're doing a fantastic job as well. When you invited me, to be here, of course, as someone here maybe understood that I was a bit nervous today, to share a little bit more about myself. I'm not used to do it in public, but I'm conscious that I need to get there because, certain stories need to be told, right? Because they can help someone else. The entrepreneurial journey is a very solo ride, the most important skill that I think everyone has to train is resilience, right? Is the ability to don't give up and, having clear in mind where, they want to go. And, once you have in mind the destination, everything that happens along the way will be absolutely magical. And so that's my biggest advice for everyone here. And I'm always, open to, so give advice or have a chat to anyone who wants to interact with me, with us as a company. So thank you so much for having me today with you. And again, very excited to have gotten this opportunity to have this conversation.
Thank you, Pietro. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned so much. Very excited to see what's next for you, what's next for Baltic, for the whole team and anyone listening. Make sure you download the app, follow them on socials, and share this episode with anyone who you think it could help as well. Thank you for listening in for today's episode with the unstoppable Pietro Novelli. I really enjoyed listening to his story. It was so filled with passion and with love, as many stories with our Italian guests. And it's just really incredible to see him reach for that success, especially from what he told us about seeing these videos early stage in his career when he was only 19 on TV about Google and just saying, yeah, that's what I want to do. And I hope today's episode can inspire others as well to reach for the stars. So Pietro, he's the founder of Voltique. Follow the company. I can't wait to see what they do next. Perhaps on your next luxury purchase, you're going to see something about them directly with the brand as well. Hope you enjoyed our conversation. Of course, don't forget to subscribe to Tech Powered Luxury. Please follow us across socials. Let us know what you've thought of season 3 so far and of today's episode. And a big, big shout out to our season 3 sponsor, Farmhouse Fresh, because without them, this wouldn't all be possible. Thank you and see you next week.